The Global Jigsaw is the podcast lifting the language barrier to show you the world through its media.
Радіо Тегерану.
Ми не вторгались на територію України.
Western countries are not the international community. That era has finished.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Richard Kagoy, and on this edition of Focus on Africa, Rwanda's Senate approves a treaty which it says guarantees the safety of the would-be migrants from the UK. We'll get more analysis. And Africa scoring very low with its citizens when it comes to policing. Why is that?
Much of that division between citizens and the police boils down to issues around bribery, issues around corruption. And that is focused very strongly on the police because issues or problems in policing are much more ubiquitous. When we talk of, say, corruption in the civil service, for example.
It's Monday, the 25th of March. First, let's start in Uganda, where the country's president, 79-year-old Yoweri Museveni, has promoted his son, General Muhoozi Kainerugaba, to head the military. This has raised concern that he's grooming his eldest child for the presidency. His son's promotion comes amid a major cabinet reshuffle in which five ministers were sacked. Mr. Museveni, who took power in 1986, has denied speculation that he's grooming his only son as his successor. General Kainerugaba is a controversial figure, becoming increasingly involved in the political arena, in breach of military protocols, and as previously said, he would run for president in the 2026 election. I spoke earlier to Solomon Serwanja, the executive director of the Africa Institute of Investigative Journalism in Uganda, for analysis.
Oh, Atamimi Nimeshukuru sana. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and it's great having you on Focus on Africa
in London
podcast.
Now.
No, I'm in Nairobi, but my colleagues are in
You're
London.
In Nairobi. Okay.
Yes, I am.
Good to hear from you, bro.
Yeah, good to hear from you. So, Solomon, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has appointed his son, Muhoozi, as an army commander. Did it come really as a surprise to you?
It didn't come as a surprise. What this really confirms to us is that President Yoweri Museveni will be on the ballot come 2026. The appointment of General Muhoozi Kainerugaba, who has previously expressed his willingness to stand for the country's top job. In fact, he has been mobilizing the young people all across the country. We've seen him hold birthday parties. We've seen him going on different campaign rallies. And he has openly tweeted about it that he wants the country's top job and that it's time for young people to take over. His appointment now as the commander of the Defense Forces, which is the country's top military job, really is going to make it very difficult for him to stand for politics or for any political position. And these are the two reasons. One, the UPDF Act clearly makes it very simple. No serving military officer can stand for the country's top job or for any political office. And so General Muhoozi Kainerugaba, by the virtue of being the commander of the Defense Forces, will not stand for elective politics. But two, he will be very, very busy commanding the UPDF, which has so many battalions, is quite a heavy job for him. The elections coming up, there are international missions. We are in, for example, in Somalia. We are in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's going to be very, very busy. And that makes it very difficult for him to concentrate on the Patriotic League in Uganda, which is a political vehicle that he had formed to start mobilizing ahead of the 2026 general election. So where is the president coming from? I think it is very clear that Muhoozi's presidential ambitions are off the discussion table.
All right. A huge responsibility on his part, but would like to understand a little bit about Muhoozi. What do we know about him?
Well, General Muhoozi Kainerugaba is a general in Uganda's military, and he has risen through the ranks. He has gone to some of the world's biggest military schools, including Sandhurst. He has been on different battlefields as well. He has gone through the ranks previously before he was dropped as the commander of the Land Forces. He was heading the Special Forces Command, which is an elite force. General Muhoozi Kainerugaba until then has been the presidential advisor on special operations. I mean, he's one of the celebrated military officers. However, his appointment into some of the top military jobs has left a section of the army grumbling, some of whom say that his promotions have been rushed. And his commands, there's a section of the army that was saying that he wasn't entirely listening from the top leadership of the army, that brought some conflict within the army. So by and large, what is important for us to note is that he's the president's son, but also two now that is heading the National Army, which really occupies a very significant place in our politics and governance structure.
You know, there's a law generally globally about, you know, people in the military offices engaging in issues to do with politics and generally public matters. But seeing him involved, going conducting rallies and doing all this sort of like mobilization, doesn't that mean that Muhoozi has always been receiving preferential treatment? And isn't that a violation of the law?
So firstly, I think it's deliberate because we have heard of the Muhoozi project, which is simply the succession plan. There are quarters within Uganda that have argued that the president is preparing his son to take over. And he has done this very strategically, including promoting him through the ranks to have, right now, he's going to be the head of the military, which is a very, very important section of Uganda's governance structure. It is deliberate. We would expect that the president would weigh in on General Muhoozi Kainerugaba's decision to actively say he's standing for active politics. The president, though he hasn't removed out the whip, we have seen different military soldiers actively getting in politics, have been whipped and have been presented before the military court martial before, which is not what General Muhoozi has received. And so there's been some preferential treatment, especially that the army is very clear. There will be no serving military officer involved in active politics. Let's get it clear, Richard. You have General Muhoozi right now, who has been politically active, and he has amassed some support from the young people, and he has expressly come out to push back against one of the key opposition figures, who is Bobi Wine in this case, the Honorable Robert Kyagulanyi. And he has, in a certain way, positioned himself as a potential political figure to take over public office. So the discussion on the street is, what happens if, for example, the president is maybe doesn't wake up, or the president, God forbid, is incapacitated? Will then the army take over the leadership of the country? And at the top of that, of the leadership of the army, is General Muhoozi Kainerugaba. So those are the conversations happening right now. Is it deliberate to prepare the son to take over? Or is it a well-orchestrated plan that was revealed by General Sejusa back then at that time, who came out to say that there's a long-term strategy to prepare Muhoozi to take over leadership once his father is out of the picture?
And that brings me to the next question here, because I'm wondering, looking at how Muhoozi has sort of like been positioning himself, don't you think then he's got undue advantage? And then what would really be the realistic chances of the opposition in the 2026 elections?
I think those chances continue to dwindle down. Look, the army is a very significant community within the government structure. Whoever has the army controls government. Right now, President Yoweri Museveni, who is the leader of the National Resistance Movement Party, which of course emerged from the National Resistance Army, is in leadership, and therefore he controls the army, and therefore controls, he has power. You have President Yoweri Museveni, who is going to be on the ballot. You have the son, who is going to protect that ballot against all odds, using any forms, and we have seen this in the past. The army, under the leadership of General Muhoozi, will go that distance to protect the vote and make sure that President Yoweri Museveni goes through without any strong resistance. On the other hand, we have Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, who is well known as Bobi Wine, who has won the hearts of many young people. And he has done a lot of activations. He has done a lot of grassroots support, mobilization. His party is just a baby and trying to find its way around politics. But he has won the hearts of many young people in Uganda and the electorate that now believes that the power is in their hands. So we are going to see a very big clash between Bobi Wine's support, which continues to grow, and President Yoweri Museveni, who is now at this time going to be backed up by the military. I think that General Muhoozi has a very, very, very big task ahead, because the conversation that we're having in Uganda is, has the army grown enough to support our democracy? And the UPDF has been largely praised as a professional army, as an army that has gone through the fire and refined to be a national army of pride. It is going to be a test for the military, whether indeed it can protect the election and make sure that Ugandans exercise their freedom to go and vote without any fear or favor, to really qualify the army as that professional, as it has been widely discussed? Or is the army going to take sides to really do everything it can to make sure that the vote is won against all odds to President Museveni's favor? Mind you, President Museveni's popularity has continued to go down. So this next election is going to be very, very critical for him. And having Muhoozi at the top leadership of the army is going to be very important for him to win the election.
Solomon Serwanja, really appreciate your insights. It's been great having you on Focus on Africa podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Solomon Serwanja, the Executive Director of the African Institute of Investigative Journalism in Uganda. Let me bring you up to date on the UK's migration deal with Rwanda. There were two developments last week, one slightly more significant than the other. The UK is still debating the legalities of the migration law, and it keeps being passed between the upper and lower houses of parliament, the House of Lords and the House of Commons. Rwanda has its own law with regard to this deal, which passed through parliament more easily and with much less disagreement. Rwanda's upper house, the Senate, passed the law with a 20-1 vote on Thursday. It now just needs President Kagame to sign it. This was the first time we heard from Rwanda on this deal, and our correspondent Barbara Plett Asher was in Kigali following the developments. She's back in Nairobi, and I managed to catch up with her.
So what happened is that the Senate voted to approve a law that would ratify this treaty that Rwanda signed with the UK in December last year. And that treaty was a response to concerns raised by Britain's Supreme Court over the safety of asylum seekers sent to Rwanda. And the provisions of the treaty are meant to strengthen guarantees around the protection of the refugees. Crucially, that they would not be deported back to their countries of origin. That was something the court raised a concern about, amongst other things. And also, the treaty is meant to improve the processing system for asylum seekers, because there was some concern that this was not adequate for what was being looked at. So that's kind of the essence of it. It's not a new law. It's meant to ratify the treaty. And of course, this is taking place at the same time that Britain is trying to pass a law off the back of that treaty, in which it quite blatantly says Rwanda is a safe country for refugees. And in fact, that's something about what the title is. Both of these legal processes are meant to pave the way to actually getting asylum seekers to Rwanda.
And while you're in Kigali, you got the opportunity to interview one of the key officials, I would say who's responsible, but has really been quite involved in discussions around this law. What did they tell you?
That's right. She is the Rwandan boss of this UK migrant agreement. Her name is Doris Uwecheza Pekar. And as you said, she was appointed to the role last week, but she has been dealing with the file since the very beginning. So this was sort of a milestone for her in her process, nearly 2 years now. So I did ask her whether this vote on the treaty would address the concerns raised by the UK courts.
The treaty was in response to the concerns of the UK Supreme Court. They needed further guarantees and safeguards. Rwanda is already a state party to the Refugee Convention and is committed to the protection of refugees. We already commit to not deporting refugees, as we are hosting currently more than 130,000 refugees.
Because that was the concern of the Supreme Court, right? That there were no guarantees Rwanda would not deport refugees to their countries of origin.
There were some guarantees, but they were not deemed enough. So on the face of the MOU that was signed prior to the treaty. Now, in the treaty, we articulate very clearly some of these guarantees, and we put in place some of the reforms for asylum process, the internal national asylum process in Rwanda, which, while adequate for the volume of asylum claims, applications that we were receiving, now needs to be scaled up to accommodate the increase in applications that we anticipate under the treaty.
So was this the monitoring mechanism and the appeal process?
Yes, the asylum process, the monitoring mechanism was already present, but it has now been strengthened with an individual complaints mechanism. There is also the guarantees as to permits, the residence permits that will be granted to the asylum seekers or the relocated individuals. So we really strengthened some of these guarantees to address those specific concerns of the court.
So there have been questions about Rwanda's human rights record, you know, touching on issues to do with freedom of speech, expression. And we heard even from the government spokesperson, Yolanda Makolo, last week here on the podcast, and she denied the criticism, saying that it was not really reflective of the situation on the ground. You spoke to Doris Uicheza Picard, and I wonder what her response was regarding this issue.
Yes, I did. Before I spoke to her, I spoke to somebody else, Victoire Ingabara, who's this political opposition figure that the government sent to jail for threatening state security and belittling the 1994 genocide. She spent a number of years there, but then was pardoned by the president, Paul Kagame. But she still can't leave the country, and she's denied political rights, so she can't run for president. She is not a fan of the UK-Rwanda deal. She says the asylum seekers will be coming to a closed country, as she puts it, and she uses her case as evidence of the cost of criticizing the government. So I asked Doris whether asylum seekers sent to Rwanda would be free to criticize the government and to hold protests if they wanted to.
The refugees, when they come here, they will be able to enjoy the full rights and responsibilities that all refugees enjoy under the Refugee Convention and under our national laws. Our national laws are very clear about the right to protest. It is protected under specific circumstances. And if they do wish to protest peacefully within the confines of the law, they're welcome to. However, you have to remember that with regards to the political activities of refugees, they're restricted by the Refugee Convention.
But the fact that some members of the Rwandan opposition have felt the need to seek asylum elsewhere, including in the UK, you do not feel that reflects on your ability to treat people equally and give them the rights they need?
No, it does not. I think we would need to look at every specific case. You will find that many people will seek asylum as a way to get a residence permit in other countries rather than really having a well-founded fear of persecution.
I know some Rwandans have looked at this and they said, well, we are a welcoming society, but Rwandans themselves need help. They need support. Why are you giving support to people from outside the country? What do you think is in it for Rwanda? What do you think Rwanda wants to achieve from this?
These are conversations I've had with loads of Rwandans in private, public, when they were asking about that. Well, what is in it for us? I mean, yes, we understand. Due to the history of our country, we were all refugees or internally displaced at some point. But beyond that, what is this deal bringing to us? And I'm always reminding people that welcoming people, that should be our end goal in and of itself. But this is also an economic development partnership. This is meant to bridge the human capital imbalance and bring opportunities closer to home. People are always fleeing from the global south, looking for opportunities in the global north. What if these opportunities were present here? And this is part of the economic development partnership, is that all who are here will benefit. It's not just going to benefit the people who are relocated under this agreement. I'll give you the example of accommodations that is being built. It's not going to just house relocated individuals, it's also going to house Rwandans who are in need of housing. It's an across-the-board improvement of the livelihoods of everybody.
Would you say there was debate in the Senate about this bill, and how much, you know, debate and discussion is happening about this process?
Well, there wasn't debate in the Senate when we were there. It was a very short session, 20 minutes. There had been a committee that was set up to look at the treaty, and it made its report saying that on all the grounds that it was investigating, the treaty was sound. And then there was a vote that was also pretty speedy, and there was a strong majority, as you would expect, 21 votes for and one against. Now, it had already gone through Parliament, and I think there was some debate in Parliament, so discussed there. And now that both houses have approved the law, it's up to Paul Kagame, the president, to actually ratify the treaty. There was that one vote against, so that was the opposition Green Party, and the argument there is an economic one. They say there will be concern about migrants competing for jobs and opportunities. Rwanda is a developing country, densely populated, already needs to look after its own poor rather than help foreigners. And I think it's not getting the same attention publicly as it is in the UK, where it's become a real issue in the media. But to the extent that there is a tension or concern, shall we say, amongst Rwandans, I would think that it's probably along those lines. What sort of economic competition might there be if Rwanda opens up for asylum seekers? Anecdotally, I would say also that some Rwandans are suspicious that this is primarily about the government consolidating its relationship with the UK. The Rwandan government argues that it wants to help, that it has given refuge to people seeking help before. They reference, for example, this agreement they've made to bring in asylum seekers from Libya, saying that that's been successful. But you know, there is a suspicion that this is really about, at least partly, part of the campaign to be seen as a useful ally of the West. That's certainly something that analysts have also been saying.
So, Barbara, then what happens now that we've seen there's been a lot of progress that's taken place, you know, in the Rwandan parliament? What happens now?
Basically, the ball is in the court of Britain to pass that law. And the House of Lords has been holding up a law that has been passed in the House of Commons by Parliament. It is expected that it will eventually pass, but that won't happen till about mid-April because Parliament has now gone on a recess for the Easter break. If that happens, if the law is passed, then the current government, the Conservative government, will do its best to try to get a plane load of asylum seekers to Rwanda as soon as possible. I think the estimates are around June would be like the earliest. And that, according to analysts, really has to do with helping to boost support for the Conservative Party before a forthcoming election later in the year. But long term, there's a real question about whether the deal has staying power, because the Labour Party, if it wins the election, has said it would scrap the policy. Having said that, this case is really being closely watched in Europe, Richard, as a test case to see whether Britain can come up with a legal framework that bypasses the European Court for Human Rights, bypasses the concerns of the European Court for Human Rights. So in that sense, it could have long-lasting implications for other countries who might want to do the same, send their asylum seekers to a third country. And that is something the African Union has warned about, that if this sort of policy is deemed legal, it would set a precedent for other states to do the same, although it hasn't specifically commented on Rwanda's policy.
All right. So thank you for that perspective, Barbara. Really been great having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Thanks very much to my colleague Barbara Plett-Usher here in Nairobi. Corrupt, brutal, and unprofessional. That's how the police are generally perceived across the African continent, according to a new survey conducted by Afrobarometer. The Independent Research Network surveyed 39 countries in total between 2021 and 2023 and found that negative perceptions of the police go hand in hand with low public trust in the forces. However, countries like Burkina Faso, Morocco, and Benin scored relatively well. I've been speaking to Temitope Oriolu, Professor of Criminology at the University of Alberta in Canada. Thank you so much for making time for us here on Focus on Africa podcast. I've been having a look at the latest survey by Afrobarometer, and what it shows that people in Africa generally have a low regard for the quality of policing. Why is there so much skepticism? Why are people so conflicted when they think about policing and policing the continent?
This is a multifaceted problem. So one has to go back to the very provenance or origins of what is now police service or police force across Africa. These were colonial creations that were specialized in expropriation. So they were generally deployed in areas involving mining or agricultural crops that were intended for export and all of that. And so that initial encounter with what we now refer to as the police, I think, soiled the grounds. And unfortunately, much of that experience has been handed on from one generation to another. But having said that, its colonial origin is not the only problem. A lot of African countries have now been independent for 50 years or more. And so clearly the political elite have had more than ample time to get it right. Now, much of that division between citizens and the police boils down to issues around bribery, issues around corruption. And that is focused very strongly on the police because issues or problems in policing are much more ubiquitous. They tend to be more visible. When we talk of, say, corruption in the civil service, for example, that's not what the average person sees on a daily basis. But the average person sees daily on the roads, on the streets, corruption and other forms of acts of indiscipline by police services. And so this is a confluence of variables, and it's been long in making. Its ties are historical, but there are also contemporary dimensions that are playing a huge role in the way that people perceive the police.
You've talked about bribery, and I'm just having a look at a newspaper report here that a prominent Nigerian film star has been arrested for allegedly attempting to bribe a police officer in the state of Kano. Just how prevalent is bribery? Is it rampant?
Oh, absolutely, yes. It's a huge problem, in part because individuals who refuse to give bribes in different kinds of circumstances are viewed as unreasonable. And of course, this may be part of a process that could lead them to trouble with the law. And so oftentimes people would try to avoid any kind of issues or any kind of trouble with the police by offering bribes. And so simple policing actions such as stops and searches and so forth, or requests for identification and all of that, are viewed as bribe-seeking behavior, even when that's not the intent. But the assumption is that that's the intent in a lot of countries, unfortunately. And so that contributes to that kind of atmosphere. Now, but a part of this, of course, is a very poor salary and welfare of police officials, such that it will take a saint, especially for those in the rank and file, it would take a saint or somebody with a level of material comfort to be in such establishments and not fall into the allure of corruption and bribery. And so clearly the lack of any serious focus on the welfare of police officers and the refusal of the elites, especially the governing elite, to recognize the importance of an effective and well-motivated and well-remunerated police service for the overall health of society is also a huge part of the issue.
You know, people encounter or interact with the police every day, whether you're on the roads, wherever you might be. And I'd just like to hear this from you. What's been your personal experience?
Many years ago, this was in 2005, I was in Lagos, Nigeria. I grew up in Nigeria and migrated to Canada for graduate studies and subsequently began my academic career. I had with me a bag, not a very expensive one, the kind of briefcase you would expect of someone who only recently completed a bachelor's degree. So I had a couple of admission letters and scholarship offers in my bag, and also a bank draft that had just obtained at a commercial bank near where I was, just literally within meters. I was approached by a gentleman who had with him a pant that suggested some kind of uniformed connection, but his top was civilian clothing. And he brandished an ID card and basically said he needed to see the content of what I was carrying. I was more than happy to show him. And he proceeded to examine those items. One of them I noticed he was viewing upside down, and unless he had specialized training in reading inverted documents, there was no way he saw what the content was. But there were a few others that he looked at, and then proceeded to say I needed to follow them to the station because I might be somebody engaged in illegal activities online. Of course, explained to him that, oh, this is what this was. Now, I was fortunate in that another officer came around, asked what was going on, took a closer look at those documents, and basically said to me, you're free to go. And that was it. Now, I imagine that If that second officer had not been on scene, that situation might not have ended well. This was bribe-seeking behavior by that first officer. Anyone who could read and write could see what those documents were, but they wanted to use this as an avenue to seek bribe. Now, that experience is not unique in any way, especially for people my age or younger who have been approached in that manner, illegal stops and searches. The constellation of those kinds of activities, especially in its most brutal form, was what gave us the whole NSAS protest a few years ago.
If I'm just looking at this report, the sense that I got is that, you know, respondents have very different experiences and their perceptions, you know, vary depending country to country, region to region. But the big question here is, why does certain countries seem to be doing fairly better compared to others?
Right. That's a great, great question. Now, you would notice that West African countries in particular are doing very poorly, with Liberia, Nigeria, and so on, compared to others in other parts of Africa. Now, one has to look at the culture, the norms, the values, but also economic and political situations in all of these countries. My point is, you cannot have a police force that is fundamentally different from the rest of society. Police officials are recruited from society, and therefore, for better or worse, they reflect us as a society. When you read daily in the papers, spectacular sums of money disappearing from government coffers, inflation of contracts by government bureaucrats and elected leaders, well, that does percolate the rest of society. And therefore, for some of these individuals, having that uniform is viewed as a meal ticket, essentially, a way to milk society, to get your own share of the national cake. And West Africa does have a lot of work to do in that regard. And these are mirrors before our eyes. These are individuals we have hired from amongst us to do this job of maintaining law and order. If we don't take care of their welfare, pay them adequately, provide the right training, and set the right example. So the tone has to come from the very top. Now, when highly placed individuals are involved in spectacular waves of corruption, you cannot have a police service that is fundamentally different from that.
All right, we may have to leave it there for now, but thank you so much for sharing with us your expertise. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Temitope Oriolu. Hashtag NSAS was, of course, a social movement that held a series of mass protests against police brutality in Nigeria in 2017. Thanks for listening to this podcast. This episode of Focus on Africa was put together by Sunita Nahar, Rob Wilson, and Yvette Twagira Maria in London. Kenny Sharp was in charge of today's production, and Chris Kuzaris was the technical producer. Andrew Lombard and Alice Modengi are our editors. Remember to check out our sister podcast, Africa Daily. It's all about one new story shaping the continent. I'm Richard Kagoe. We'll talk again next time.
Water used as a weapon of war.
In none of these villages there was any piped clean water for people.
A nation in the grip of criminal gangs.
How bad does it have to get before the international community reacts?
A country showing signs of fracture.
Right now with Sudan, things are really quite dark. The nation is divided. The mistrust runs so deep.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service is back for a new series. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.